This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a major free speech academic freedom victory in the Stephen Salida case. The university attempted to throw out the case. They failed. And Chancellor Phyllis Wise, one of the several people responsible for getting him fired, was forced to resign. In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we have a special place for attorney and professor Holly McGuigan.
Holly is a criminal defense attorney. You'll not just like her, you'll love her. And her storytelling, like every defense lawyer, is beyond belief.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
There was a major federal court victory in Illinois on the Stephen Salida case last week. Federal Judge Harry Leinenweber ruled that the university had failed in its attempt to get Salida thrown out of court. He upheld Salida's allegations that his First Amendment rights were violated. He upheld Salida's allegations that his due process rights were violated. He upheld the allegations that he had a contract, and he said, this case has to proceed to discovery, and I'm not going to throw it out at this point. And the judge took a very strong position with respect to both the contract and freedom of speech. So it looks like the University of Illinois is on a losing path. The day after the decision came down, Chancellor Wise, who was one of the people responsible for firing Professor Salida, resigned from her job. And we're going to speak today with one of Professor Stephen Salida's attorneys, the deputy legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Maria LaHood, who's handling the case with Chicago attorneys Lovey and Lovey by their associate Anand Swaminathan. And Maria is going to tell us what the implications of this latest decision are. Attorney Maria LaHood, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
You know, you had a tremendous victory in the Salida versus Kennedy case. My opinion, the most important free speech academic case to come along since the 1960s. But I wanted to ask you first about the background of Professor Stephen Salida, who was fired from his job at the University of Illinois. And if you could give us the background, then we can talk about this great victory that came down last week. So please, what's the background on the Salida case, Maria?
Well, Professor Salida was a tenured professor at Virginia Tech, and he had accepted an offer from the University of Illinois to be a tenured faculty member of their American Indian Studies program, which he was thrilled about, and, you know, had quit his job. His wife had quit her job. They took their son out of school. They were prepared to move. This was a year ago, actually. And it was, you know, over the summer during Israel's assault on Gaza, so-called Operation Protective Edge, and he was tweeting, outraged about what was happening in the killing of children. And on August 2nd, he received an email. This was literally two weeks before he was set to start working. He was moving across, you know, planned to move across the country. The movers were coming. The university was paying for them. And he received an email from Chancellor Weiss basically saying, you know, she wouldn't be recommending him to the board for approval of his appointment. In other words, don't bother to show up.
But meanwhile, as you say, they paid for their moving expenses. He had acted in reliance on their promise, gave up his home, put a down payment on a place to live. He had been assigned an office. He'd been assigned classes.
Right.
He picked the books he wanted to use. He had been given a welcoming party at the school. I mean, everything was in place.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the decision, because the university relied on one clause in the letter that was sent to him offering him the job, which, of course, he signed and accepted the offer. Mm-hmm. But one clause said there's going to be a meeting of the board a month or so after you start working, and that was the clause they were relying on to say that because the board finally rejected him, therefore he didn't have the job. But the judge talked about that, and we'll get into that in a minute. But let's talk about the various causes of action that you put into your complaint that the judge upheld because the university said, we want this case summarily thrown out of court. We want summary judgment that you don't state anything that's illegal and therefore you don't belong here. And the judge disagreed. So let me go through the various points that you made and how the judge upheld you on them. You said that Professor Salida was exercising his First Amendment rights in the tweets that he made about the killing of over 500 children in Gaza. And he tweeted about that. And you alleged that the university was retaliating under the civil rights law, retaliating for his tweets. And the judge upheld you on that. Talk to us about that, please.
Okay, well, first to clarify, this was a motion to dismiss. So, you know, the university was arguing that even if everything, you know, Stephen says is true, this case should be dismissed on the law. Frankly, very little of what is, you know, is alleged in the complaint, I think, is even disputed by the university. You know, they were arguing that, as you said, the contract language, which said that this, you know, is subject to the appointment is subject to approval by the Board of Trustees, they claimed a contract wasn't even formed. We said, of course, a contract was formed. He accepted it. He, you know, it was, you know, all the things that you mentioned, which made it clear that he was to be employed as of August 16th. And moreover, the Board of Trustees wasn't scheduled to even approve the appointment until a month after everyone started. So the first claim was just a basic breach of contract claim. They breached his contract. And the court said, yes, that's right. There was a contract. There was an offer. There was an acceptance. Even if that wasn't clear, look at all the things the university did, like, again, paying for his move, et cetera. And he said, you know what? If there weren't a contract here, the entire American academic hiring process as it now operates would cease to exist.
Those words just jumped.
This is how it works.
Jumped off the page of the judge's decision. He said, quote, if the court accepted the university's argument, the entire American academic hiring process as it now operates would cease to exist. You know, wow.
Yeah.
Because
it's true. I mean,
why is
this
that
is
true?
What people do. They quit their jobs. They plan to move across country, you know, up their whole lives and their families' lives, in reliance on a contract from a university. And if this were true, all the other people who were set to start and did start teaching at the university, they could have, you know, the university could have terminated them a month in or, you know, 3 weeks in before the board's meeting and say, we didn't have a contract with you. We weren't, you know, and they were already employed. They were already working. They were already teaching.
Yeah, 120 of them started. Stephen didn't start.
Yeah.
But
you know, that was our one. I mean, we had a contract claim. And you know, frankly, the university and the defendant's arguments all sort of relied, or many of them relied, on there not being a contract, which the court resoundingly rejected. But then, you know, we also had a claim under the First Amendment, as you said, arguing that Professor Salida was retaliated against because of his tweets about Gaza. And this, you know, they admitted that their decision was based on his tweets, right? So, again, not much of a dispute here. But the court said, yes, these tweets implicate, quote, every central concern of the First Amendment, unquote.
That's pretty
heavy. You
know,
they were political speech. They were in a public forum. And here the university's actions were based on their content. Doesn't matter if it's the content, meaning the viewpoint, or if it's, you know, that he used a cuss word, it doesn't matter. We can't, you know, you can't distinguish between those things. This is a violation of the First Amendment.
But the university said it's really an example of this man acting so uncivilly that we could never get along with him if he came here. We, of course, support the First Amendment, but it's not that. It's the kind of character this guy is, demonstrated by the language he used in these tweets. What did you make of that argument?
They called him uncivil from the beginning. I don't know if they didn't really say they couldn't get along with him. There was no claims that he wasn't collegial or anything else. They claimed, you know, we're not sure the students will feel comfortable with him.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's never had any issue. And, you know, in fact, he's had the highest student evaluations, always extremely respectful. You know, it's a much different world in the classroom than it is, you know, in a 140-character tweet. But regardless, even if that were the reason, that still violates the First Amendment. You know, you can't separate the tone and the language from the First Amendment. That's part of it.
You know, this goes back to those cases in the 60s where professors were fired because they were in the Communist Party, or they refused to say they weren't in the Communist Party, or they wouldn't sign a loyalty oath. And that was the device that was used to weed out radicals from the university. And it seems to me they're doing the same thing to people like Professor Salida, who are Palestine solidarity activists.
Right, right. And they use, you know, they use words like uncivil or divisive, or because there are people who passionately disagree with him and are, you know, are advocates, sort of uncritical advocates of the state of Israel. And that was one of the issues. We, you know, we found out through FOIA documents that there were donors who threatened that they would withhold future donations if he weren't fired, essentially. So that was unfortunately one of the claims we lost in the case. We had sued unnamed donors, John Doe donors, for intentional breach of contract and business relations, basically saying they induced Chancellor Wise and others into breaching Professor Salida's contract, and that's a violation of the law. They had done it, you know, they had said basically an ultimatum or a quid pro quo, we won't give further donations if he's at the university.
But the judge said they have a First Amendment right to give their opinion to the university.
Right. It's interesting. He, you know, he went through the elements of the torts and said, yes, these are all, you know, these are all satisfied. This would be tortious interference with a contract, but, you know, they have a First Amendment right to speak their minds. I mean, I don't think someone should be able to use the First Amendment as a shield to help violate someone else's First Amendment rights or otherwise violate the law, both of which were done here. But, you know, that was one of the few, you know, Professor Salida won his most significant claims and against the university, but that was one that was dismissed. And frankly, you know, in the end, the university is responsible for the decisions it made, regardless of who pressured it with whatever threats. It is what it is.
I know, but when the case was first unfolding and we learned that there were these various militant pro-Israel donors to the university. One emailed her, emailed Chancellor Wise, and she destroyed that email. Another one actually met with her, and you kind of got the idea that it was the whole Zionist power structure in the state of Illinois and maybe in the country that came down, because Salida was not an unknown person. Obviously, they were following him through his tweets. It's unfortunate, I thought, because we could have implicated this behind-the-scenes maneuvering that goes on to get rid of people like Salida and many professors before him.
Yeah.
So I was
disappointed
in that decision.
No, it is too bad. Well, we'll get to that later, but we don't know what all Chancellor Wise has deleted. I mean, I think, you know, you might have been referring to the two-pager that was given to her by a donor, which is cited in one of her emails, which is what we had brought a spoliation claim based on, that and anything else we didn't know about.
Well, that's a $2 word, Maria, spoliation. Let's talk about what spoliation means, because we lost that claim also.
Yeah.
And what was the allegation that you made, and why did we lose the spoliation claim?
We had claimed that she had intentionally destroyed evidence that was central to the lawsuit, including this two-pager that she references in an email that was given to her by a donor about Professor Salida. We lost that claim. The judge basically found it's a high standard in Illinois. We had said basically she had a duty under the Illinois State Records Act to preserve evidence related to his firing. She also knew that litigation was coming. You know, now we know she knew that. She expected that before she even sent him his termination letter. You know, there was an email that came out from her on July 31st that basically said, no matter who sends this letter, it's the beginning of a lawsuit and I'll end up being deposed. You know, so she anticipated it early on. I mean, we later, you know, from this release, and we can get to it, but this release of documents, we also know that she was using her private email to avoid transparency under FOIA. And that she admitted in an email deleting emails after sending them, even on her private email. So that's a whole other area. But we lost the spoliation claim. Although, I mean, query whether that can't be reopened, given the admission and what else has transpired. But again, most of, you know, besides that and the claim against the donors, everything was allowed to move forward. Our contract claim, our First Amendment claim, our due process claim, our conspiracy claim. The only other claim dismissed was, you know, intentional infliction of emotional distress, which, you know, was a tort.
Yeah.
So overall, a really, really great victory with great language from the court.
Well, it's so extraordinary, the victory, that you wonder what's going to come next. Now, I understand about a month ago the total legal bill was close to $1 million. The university had spent a lot of taxpayers' money defending this thing.
Right.
And then shortly after the decision came down, Chancellor Wise resigned.
Mm-hmm.
She gave up her $590,000 a year job, and she's taking a year off on a sabbatical. And then they say she's going to be invited back for $400,000 a year to teach.
Right. Well, yeah, she had her current salary might be, you know, close to $550,000. She's getting, well, the board will be voting on whether to approve a $400,000 payment to her, which evidently is what she's claiming is the rest of her contract. And then she's guaranteed, you know, she gets her year paid sabbatical, and she's guaranteed at least a $300,000 salary or something around there as a faculty member.
But
then there are her, I think she has counsel that, you know, there's I think $175,000 at least has been spent on outside counsel just to handle this inquiry about her use of private emails and other administrators' use. So it's, I mean, the amount of money being spent on this is incredible. And all, you know, she gets to go back to her job as a faculty member. What about Professor Salida? He still doesn't have full-time employment, tenured employment.
No, but hopefully it'll be a great irony if she's gone and Professor Salida, who now is the Edward Said Professor of American Studies at American University in Beirut, quite a prestigious position.
Right.
And but it's only a temporary assignment.
Right. It's just a one-year appointment.
Wouldn't it be ironic if he comes back and she's gone? But,
right.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I have no expectation, I guess, that she'll be.
We're getting ahead of ourselves here because my next question would be, the university has been disgraced as a consequence of this. The American Association of University Professors has censored the university for what they did. The Modern Language Association, a number of professional groups have. There are 5,000 professors who have said they'll boycott the university. A number of conferences have been canceled. And the University of Illinois is looking terrible. Mm. And so you wonder if they want to continue this nosebleed, both to their reputation and to their pocketbook. You wonder. But so what are the next steps in the litigation?
Well, we're continuing with discovery. You know, we're still obviously receiving documents. It seems like there are many more to be received. And then it'll be time to start taking depositions. So, you know, it's, as you said, I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, these emails have displayed a lot of interesting things about the decision-making. I mean, one, you know, there was an email from Wise in response to the CAFT report, the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, basically upset that, you know, the CAFT believed that she made this decision about Professor Salida and that the Board of Trustees just followed her recommendation. And she says that's just plain not true. And she was, you know, sick of, as she said, carrying the water. There were emails to that effect. So her resignation is something, but she's not the only one responsible here. You know, the board was also responsible. And frankly, there were some people that were also in the loop on the decision-making. What's really interesting about seeing those emails is how no one questions this decision. No one questions what Professor Salida's tweets meant. No one questions whether the decision to terminate him is wrong or whether others should be consulted. And it's, you know, this is who she's the limited number of people she's consulting with. And it's just, you know, it really shows you how power corrupts, especially when no one is challenging it. No one's raising these issues. And of course, you know, after the decision is made, there's a groundswell, like you mentioned, condemning it. Even since her resignation, you know, there have been more calls for reinstatement than ever. The UIUC Campus Faculty Association is calling for reinstatement. People who before supported his firing are calling for his reinstatement. I mean, it's, yet still, I don't know. What are they going to do that? I mean, they're doing quite a bit, it seems, to try to put this behind them. But the, you know, the one thing that can really help them do that is finally reinstating Professor Salida.
You know, if you step back and take a look at what's happening to the university system, because this is what's happened to a place where I went to college next door at the University of Wisconsin, and now you see it at Illinois, where the departments are being told, you have to raise your own funds, you're not going to get it, no longer really a public university, and you have to go out and hustle money. I mean, I got a letter from the political science department selling coffee mugs. I thought that was pitiful. But at the University of Illinois, I think you told us a couple months ago that some 80 or 90% of the funds they get are private funds.
Right.
So you can see how, just like they're trying to privatize public schools with the voucher system, these universities, which were the great institutions from the 19th century, and they're being privatized too, in a sense.
Yeah. This is as much about the corporatization of the American university as it is about many things. You see their concern about donors, their need for money, all of these issues are related.
What did Dylan say? Money doesn't talk, it swears?
Yeah.
The people swearing at the university certainly don't share the values of a liberal university. Not if they're going to behave like you described, with not even taking cognizance of what Salida was tweeting about with all the people being bombed and killed in Gaza, and they just brush over that.
Mm-hmm.
Or I read some of these private emails of Chancellor Wise. I think there were 294 pages of them, which she neglected to disclose. Illegally, I would guess, neglected to disclose. She and her several advisors were trying to figure out how to get around the academic freedom First Amendment aspects of this. That kind of, cynicism. Corrupt is a good word. Decadent is a word that comes to mind. But I think you attorneys on this case are really going to have a good time with your depositions.
It'll be interesting. I mean, that when you're talking about the things that were said in the emails, another one that came out that Chris Kennedy, former chair of the Board of Trustees, said basically the university, as the state's public university, needs to in many ways reflect the values of the state. And by that, I think it's the power of the state. And he, shortly after, the Simon Wiesenthal Center had pressured, the university to fire Salida, he was awarded their Spirit of Courage Award for leading the Board of Trustees in firing Salida. I mean, that was just openly what the award was for, which is pretty...
It's chilling.
Yeah.
Instead of having the state be an instrument of the population, they've turned it on their head.
Right.
And you've got that top down.
And it's of the powerful, of the folks who can pay for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there's a word for that. but in any case, I think that this litigation is shining a lot of light where the sunshine needs to be shined. And you and the Lovey and Lovey firm and Anand Swami Nathan in Chicago should be congratulated for the superb legal work that you've done on this. When do you think the depositions are going to start up?
I'm not sure yet. Hopefully soon.
Good, good. Well, Maria LaHood.
None of this, of course, could have been possible without the grassroots advocacy and all the support that Professor Salida has received, and at least the media who has covered it, exposing what's happened.
It's really an indication that the tide has turned against the depredations of the Israeli government against the Palestinians. So I think it's an aspect of the movement here, and it's just a tremendous victory. Maria LaHood, do you have any final thoughts for us?
It's been an incredible week, and I maybe more is coming. So stay tuned.
Well, I'm sure more is coming, and when it does, we'll have you back on. Maria LaHood, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Series, we're joined now by Holly McGuigan, a professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law. Holly teaches at the Comparative Criminal Justice Clinic at NYU. She serves on the boards of directors at the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women and the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Holly is a past co-president of the Society of American Law Teachers, SALT, which is the largest membership organization of law professors in the United States. She's about to be honored by SALT in January as a great law teacher. Holly, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Holly, you had a kind of a career switch because I think you were studying medieval literature, English literature, and then wound up in law school. Tell us about that.
Well, I was doing medieval history, actually, and I was at Berkeley. And it was 1967, and Oakland stopped the draft. Well, and I was still interested in medieval history, but I got very interested in the anti-war politics. I'd been interested in anti-racism politics before, but I always thought I could do my main intellectual love and my political love simultaneously. They didn't have to be the same. And I hated lawyers. I really hated lawyers. They were boring. They talked about themselves all the time. They only had stories about their cases and how great they were. And they would never post bail when people got arrested. So I had like very little use for lawyers. But I went to a meeting. I had moved to Santa Cruz from Berkeley. And I was at a meeting planning the People's Park demonstrations in 68 in California. And this guy takes the microphone and starts reading, and there's another guy in the back of the room who starts ululating. It's like right out of Battle of Algiers. It's unbelievable.
What's ululating mean? That's a big word for someone
like
me.
It's like making a sound that I can't make, but it's like making a kind of keening, howling, keening. Wonderful sound. And he came running up to the mic and grabbed the mic and said, every time a suit tries to read you something, stop them. There's all these surveillance cameras here.
What's a suit? He's like got, a lawyer wearing
like
a suit?
Like a person wearing a suit. And he says, there's all these surveillance cameras. They all know you're here. This means this. What he's reading is a John and Jane Doe injunction against the march on People's Park. They've got cameras. They can every one of you is in criminal contempt if you now do the march, if you let him finish reading the injunction. Now, just don't ever let anybody. Just shriek, yell, do whatever sound you want to make. I thought that was so cool. That was the best. The most useful thing I'd ever seen a lawyer do in my life. So I went home. My fiancé was applying to law schools, despite my complaints. You're much too nice a person to go to law school. You shouldn't go to law school. And I was applying to history PhD programs. So I went home and I said, give me every application you haven't filled out. And I took it to a copy shop and I made copies. And so I applied to every law school whose application he hadn't finished. We were right up against the deadline.
Great way to select the law schools.
It's as good as any, you know.
Or a profession for that matter.
Worked out well.
Which one accepted you?
We decided to go to the school that accepted us both and gave me the most money because his family had money, but mine didn't. And that was the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which is where I stayed then for 17 years.
Well, let's talk about that because you had the one of the preeminent constitutional and criminal defense law firms, Carey's, Rudofsky, and McGuigan in Philadelphia. And you were there during a time when Frank Rizzo was the police chief.
And then the mayor.
And then the mayor. And we'll talk about Frank also. But I want to talk to you about your law practice and the kind of cases that you took there and how you developed into a criminal defense lawyer and a constitutional lawyer, because that leads right into your then becoming a teacher. But let's talk about the old days in Philly.
How'd you start out? I love that. Well, first, I started out as a public defender. I loved being a public defender. It was the beginning and end of everything I had hoped it would be. It was just great. And that's where I met David Rudofsky and David Carey's. They were then defenders when I was a student. And after they went out on their own, they invited me to join them. And I kept putting it off because I loved being a defender so much. I knew that working with them would be fabulous. I mean, there's no question. I just kept deferring it till finally they said, you know what? We can't wait any longer. We have to, like, go someplace else. What?
But let me ask you, I understand you loved being a public defender, but I've had other friends who've been public defenders. And, you know, it's not exactly wonderful job in certain ways because the people you meet have been so oppressed by the system and your chances of giving them anything meaningful is very hard. I mean, I've had friends who just said, I can't stand being in here. I can't go into the pens anymore with 50, you know, African Americans or Latinos that are just being harassed by this society. So how did you psychologically,
I don't know the answer to that, except that, first of all, in Philadelphia, there was much more actual litigation. Not just motion litigation. There's a lot of that here in New York City. But actual trials. Lots of trials. So you really had a shot at getting somebody off. And you had a sense, there was an analysis, that people were doing life on the installment plan. And that what you needed was to do what you could to kick them loose any particular time. And your clients understood that. There were limits to what you could do. The system wasn't the least bit fair. But people really appreciated the fact that there were lawyers at the Defender Association who were willing to give everything they had to get them out. And so it inspired you. You know what I mean? There was never a morning you got up and thought, why am I doing this? You know? And it was, in many ways, a difficult office to work in, because instead of representing a client from beginning to end, which you didn't get to do until it was a major case, for the life on the installment plan cases, you know, the ordinary misdemeanors and low-level felonies, it was what's called vertical representation. You represented a room. But even so, you got to know people. So when you went to the jail, there were people who called your name and you knew their names. And it was, you know, it was a community in its own odd way. And it was very difficult for me to leave it. I found it very painful to leave.
But did you have any, how many years were you there, Holly?
I was there 3 years.
So you didn't really get to the highest level death penalty cases, right?
And there weren't then. There was no death penalty in Pennsylvania then. So I got to the
highest. It's a Quaker state, Michael.
Right.
No, there is now.
Yes, right. There is now, for sure. But you moved quite quickly if you worked hard in that office. So I was doing major felonies within a couple years. Yeah.
Let's go into private practice now.
Okay.
You go in with Carey's and Rudofsky, who I sat next to in law school because I'm Smith and he's R. And that's how it was arranged at NYU. But anyway, he goes to Philly. You wind up in Philly. They invite you to join the firm. It was one of those famous movement firms. Talk about what the three of you did.
Well, we did actually a lot of different things. David Carey's was very focused on constitutional litigation and government misconduct. Not to say he didn't do criminal stuff. He did the Camden 28, which was a big draft-resisting case in the late 70s. And Dave Carey's did a lot of police misconduct and some criminal defense. And my interest was more in the criminal defense. I liked that part better. I did police misconduct because the legal worker in that office, Jaima Abdu, who then came to New York and was office staff for the National Office of the National Lawyers Guild, Jaima was really a brilliant litigator. And she just gave me my marching orders and told me what to do. And so I did what she said. So it was a mix of things, and we try. And I did a lot of grand jury stuff in that time.
But that was political, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of cases, like?
Like the Patty Hearst grand jury was one of the first ones. It's where I met Bill Kunstler and Margie Ratner, now Margaret Ratner Kunstler.
Most people won't know what the Patty Hearst case was.
Well, it was. There was a grand jury convened. It was actually, it met all over the country, or several of them met, to investigate the alleged transportation of Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army from California, where she had been captured, to
Captured by the
Symbionese Liberation Army.
It's a great story.
It's one of the great stories. At that time, I was involved with a man who was working for Mo Udall for president. And Mo Udall said something that annoyed me about the SLA. And Paul Tully calls me up and he says, let me just understand this. I don't get to come home until Mo goes on the network and says the SLA are my kind of people.
Again, the SLA is Symbionese Liberation Army. Right. Patty Hearst was, of course, an heir to the
Hearst fortune. Right.
And she's kidnapped. She's like not necessarily part of anything.
No. Kidnapped because she was a Hearst.
Right.
No, it was nothing she did. Nothing she did. So anyway, so these grand juries were convened, and I got a call from the Center for Constitutional Rights, about which you two know everything there is to know, and I bet your listeners do also. And I got a call just about being emergency counsel if there was a stay requested from a Harrisburg grand jury. And I was very excited, because on the phone were Bill Kunstler and Rhonda Copeland and all these people whose names I knew but I didn't know. And they're explaining what they want me to do as if we were in the Second Circuit. It's a very New York thing. You assume the way things work in New York is the way they work everywhere. And that if everybody says that's not how they work, they think you just don't get it. So I was explaining the way the Third Circuit works. And I said, I need more. I need you to send me the papers. I need some reason to say why we have to wait for Bill and Doris and whoever else to get here. Because otherwise, they'll just make me argue. Oh, no. I said, trust me. This is the Third Circuit. This is a different place. This is what they do. You file an emergency appeal, an application for a stay. They get a judge who's available. You have to go in. So it was apparently they hung up the phone then and said, we got a live one in Philadelphia. Let's rope her in. So that's how I got involved. And it was fun. We went all over. And we knew ultimately we were going to lose. You always lose. But you can cause a lot of delay and quite a bit of havoc if you're creative and energetic.
Were there witnesses you were representing in front of the grand jury?
Yeah. I represented Jay Weiner, who was then a sports writer who'd been blackballed because of his connection with the sports left. Remember Jack Scott and Mickey Scott in the Mexico Olympics
and the African Americans who raised their fists.
Exactly.
And they were involved with those people.
Yes. Right. So he was supposed to, after being graduated from college, go to local, I won't name it because I'm actually kind of fond of this newspaper, but a local newspaper that then withdrew the job offer. And he was working as a cook, actually not a bad cook at all, in a local vegetarian eatery in Philadelphia until the grand jury was over. He did some time. He was at Allenwood. But he got good advice from other clients of mine. So he
refused to testify.
He refused to testify and was held in contempt.
And the issue again was how the kidnapping and transportation.
It was any information about it. He wouldn't give any information at all about what he may have known about what his friends were up to.
Because they're looking for Patty Hearst everywhere, right, at this point.
Right. At this point, they're looking for Patty Hearst or anybody who might have been involved in her kidnapping and transportation. This is after they had firebombed that house in Oakland. I mean, this was after a lot of tragedy. And so he ended up going to prison, but not for all that long, because one of the things you can do is then torture the judge until he lets him out. So we did that, and we got him out. So could have been worse.
Let's talk about some more of your cases while you were doing criminal defense law in Philadelphia, because at that time Frank Rizzo was unfortunately around. Talk to us about him and the contention between your firm and his policies.
Well, he was a killer. I mean, there's no question. Under his tenure as commissioner of police and then as mayor, more people died as a result of police actions than before or since. I mean, one of the amazing things was that the next mayor, who was no great shakes, saw the number of deaths decrease by 33% just in the first 6 months of his time. It was a time when police were really green-lighted to do whatever they wanted and told it was the right thing to do. I don't mean to suggest that all the police started out homicidal. What I mean to suggest is this was a situation in which from the top down came the message, if you're a good cop, then you're going to take people out however you think you need to. And he himself was very sporty about it. You know, he liked to go out in a cummerbund in his night clothes with a nightstick stuck in his tuxedo cummerbund and round people up. I mean, and humiliate people. I mean,
yeah, look what he did to the Panthers.
Exactly. I was thinking about his invasion of the Black Panther Party headquarters in Philadelphia and his bringing out everybody who was found in there and forcing them to strip and stand naked on the street in the cold while he walks behind them wielding his nightstick. It was gross. It was horrible. It was really a very, very bad time.
So what did you folks at the law firm do litigation-wise in this situation?
We did a lot of criminal defense, of course, and a lot of litigation against the police tactics and at all different levels, right? I mean, David and David did a lot of excessive force litigation, a lot of illegal search litigation. I tended to do litigation about people who were targeted more because of who they were. But together we did a lot. And the reality is, in that kind of situation, organizing is absolutely as important as litigating. And it was hard sometimes to keep your eye on the ball, you know what I mean, to remind yourselves that the litigation was one piece of a strategy, that unless people made it clear that they weren't going to tolerate this police violence, a judge's ruling or a jury's decision wasn't going to matter that much. But it's interesting. You get involved in litigation and then you think, oh, this is it. This is it. This is the greatest. And people who were normally wearing thuggy clothes and feeling like they were wanted to show how tough they were are coming in little suits. And you say, Michael, what are you doing? He says, my mother's coming. You know, it's like, so it's important. And the lawyers play into that a lot. I mean, you really have to keep being mindful of the fact that you cannot ask people to take time away from organizing for litigation, that the litigation has to be just part of the whole strategy.
Now, did you develop any kind of specialty while you were working with Carrie Zrodowski and McGuigan?
Kind of by accident, I did, in a way. By the time we'd worked together for several years, I thought I knew about race and class bias in the courtroom as much as a white woman who was middle class could know. And then I got assigned to represent a woman who was accused of killing her abusive boyfriend. And I was just blown away by what happens when you add hatred of women to hatred of black people and hatred of poor people. It stunned me. It absolutely stunned me. I just had no idea. So, I mean, yes, I had some specialties before that. You know what I mean? I did some grand jury stuff, and I represented a lot of gay groups who were being harassed in various parts of the city, and but this thing just stunned me. And I called the judge who assigned me to this homicide to say, why me? Why did you assign me to this? And he said, oh, you just came up next, you know. It was like Philadelphia was very corrupt at that time, so he was one of the few judges who didn't demand money to be on the list to get a Oh, I'm telling you, judges would go by me in the hall and say, oh, McGuigan, you didn't give me anything this Christmas, not even one lousy bottle. You're not getting any assignments.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Judges would do things like they'd open the drawer in their chambers, and there'd be you know, wads of bills, and they'd let you know what they wanted. Oh, I had one time I was litigating a motion to suppress, and the judge said, it's just about time for the lunch and recess. I bet between now and 2:15, you and your client will come up with 200 reasons why I should rule in his favor.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
That guy's cheap.
Stunning, right? So, well, it was a long time ago. And if you get 200 from everybody, right, you see what I mean? It's not that cheap.
That's amazing.
And 200 is within reach for a lot of people.
Those are amazing stories.
It was an incredible time. About the specialty.
Your specialty in bribing judges, but your specialty
in law. I was famous for not bribing them. So this guy gave me this case because I didn't bribe anybody. I was like known for... So he assigned me this case for no particular reason. And I went... This is the first time, to my knowledge, I now realize I had represented a lot of women who'd been victimized by intimate partner violence. I just didn't recognize, I didn't know, you know, I just didn't know. But this was the first time that I was aware that that was what was going on. So I went to this restaurant where what happened was he attacked her in a restaurant and pushed her back through the tables. She fell out of her shoes. She was knocking things off the tables as she went by, asking people for help. This is what she tells me, crying out for people to help her because he's strangling her and she can barely breathe. And they get to the back of the restaurant where there's a carving table, and she picked up a knife and stabbed him in the arm, meaning to get him just in the arm to make him stop. But because of the knife was very sharp. They were in a restaurant. And because of a birth defect or a birth, you know, anomaly, his heart was very close to the chest of his wall. It was far, so the knife pierced his heart and he died instantly on the spot. So I hire an investigator and I say, go to this place, it's around the same time, and see if there are any witnesses, because it's a neighborhood place and maybe there are people who go there every evening for an early dinner. And the investigator calls me and says, you have to come here. I go, I do not have to come here. I'm in court tomorrow. Excuse me, Joe. You're the expert investigator, and I'm the litigator. I do not. Trust me. You have to stop whatever you're doing, and you have to come here. So wow. I went there, and there were all these people in the restaurant, including a couple guys sitting at the bar. And Joe turns to them and says, tell her what you just told me. So they all look around, and one guy kind of collects himself and says, basically what she had said to me. He describes the scene. It starts out, remember cigarette machines? It starts out by the cigarette machine just inside the door. And he's saying, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. And she's asking for help and nobody's helping. And,
wow.
And I say to him, why didn't you help her? And he says, we feel so bad about it now. But at the time, we didn't know they weren't married.
What?
So I thought, okay, what? This is a whole new world.
Right. It would have been wrong. If they'd been married, it would have been okay.
Right. So I called the Women's Self-Defense Project, and I said, I really need help. I don't have any idea how to pick a jury. It's like, how do you pick a jury in a case? I mean, I'm used to picking juries in street crimes and the odd federal case, but it's mainly... where the focus is on a person for reasons that are hideous, not because of reasons of anything they actually did. I have no idea. So it changed everything for me. So I developed something of a specialty in women who kill men. There is that. Although I should hasten to say that some of my best friends are men.
I appreciate that. You married one of ours.
And, I'm saying and, that my own personal husband is a very nice man. Right?
Although Michael did just pull his chair 2 feet farther from
he
Holly.
Did.
Now, what year was this? Because this is the very beginning of really the establishment of this.
Of the notion that women could claim self-defense
right.
and be reasonable.
I
instead
think,
of
mid-'80s, right. earlier?
No, late 70s.
Late
70s,
okay.
It was... Liz Schneider was doing her work then in New York.
Right,
the
Women's
Self-Defense Project,
Rights,
right, at the Center for Constitutional Rights was doing their work. So it was the start, for me, this started in the late 70s. And then in the early 80s, a group in Philadelphia called Women Against Abuse began working. And they did advocacy for battered women accused of crime. And it made a huge difference. It meant that we could collaborate with people who were really knowledgeable about the dynamics of intimate partner violence, and about who to use as expert witnesses if you decided to use an expert witness, and about how to get in touch with them and what to do. It made a huge, huge difference.
Oh, a remarkable experience. There's a number of other experiences while you were a criminal defense lawyer, but one that I know you mentioned to us was your argument in the Supreme Court.
Right.
But why don't you talk about that?
There was an issue running around about a person accused of crime and their right to cross-examine certain statements. And it was a question about the Sixth Amendment and the right to do it. And it was coming up in the Ninth Circuit, which is California, and in the Third Circuit, which is mainly Pennsylvania, although also Delaware and parts of New Jersey. So we were aware of all the litigation that was going on, and I was trying a case with this guy who was characterized by the newspapers as a rogue ex-cop who taught me a lot, actually. He taught me how to move because he used to arrest what then we called second-story men, you know. And he taught me about how you get a double hefty garbage bag and you tie it with a square knot and you can carry almost anything. Since then, I've never moved any other way. I only move with garbage bags. They're very strong. They're very forgiving. So anyway, this guy was – I'd represented him for years. He got in all kinds of entertaining trouble, and it was fun, you know, and mainly we won. And David Radofsky and I collaborated in a couple cases. Sometimes they went after him. And they would search his house, and then David would sue them for the Fourth Amendment violation and earn enough money to pay our fee, and that just annoyed them so much. So in this case, we lost, and we appealed it to the Third Circuit, but appealed it having made a record that we knew satisfied the standards of the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit. Well, arguably that was a tactical error, because then when the government applied for cert, it was
cert being the way.
A petition for certiorari is an application to the Supreme Court to hear an appeal, which they wouldn't hear as of right. And most criminal appeals, you have to petition for certiorari in order to get the Supremes to hear it. So they petitioned, and I say to my friends, we are dead in the water. This is it. They're going to grant cert in our case and not in one of the Ninth Circuit cases, and we are so dead. So by this time, David had stopped doing quite so much litigation. Dave Radofsky had done a lot of, had been being the trainer for the Defender Association. And Dave Carries was moving into teaching. So I had started this other firm with Edmund Tyriac and Julie Shapiro and Leslie Engel to do more litigation. So by the time this case went to the Supreme Court, that was the team. And I said to them, you know what? Once the cert petition was granted, which meant the Supreme Court was going to hear the appeal, it was over. It was totally over. So I said to them, we cannot let this take over our lives. It's true, it's the major leagues. On the other hand, we could write the best brief in history or submit no brief at all. And we're going to have Marshall and Brennan dissenting. We could do the best argument ever or fall down in a dead faint from panic, and we'll have Marshall and Brennan dissent. Let's not forget, this is six troglodytes and three dweebs, and it's just not going to work out for us. Our team is not going to win here. So we tried really hard not to get caught up in it. But it's, you know, there is a mystique about arguing in the Supreme Court. Well, you know, right? It's like a thing. So we ended up putting a whole lot of energy into the brief and a whole lot of energy into the argument. And in the end, do I need to say we had Marshall and Brennan dissenting? There was no choice. But anyway, it was entertaining. It was fun. It was kind of exciting. My mother came. And oh, actually, and this particular charge was a charge of manufacturing methamphetamine. So I practiced. I wanted to say to the justices, excuse me, Mr. Chief Justice, justices, could we not mention methamphetamine? My mother's here. She thinks I'm a civil rights lawyer.
You know, this has been an extraordinary interview for me, and I think it will be for everybody who hears it. And so I hesitate to ask you, because you've already said it, what you would recommend to people about becoming lawyers, and of course we're going way down in the number of lawyers that are applying to law school, or people are applying to law school.
Lowest now since 1975.
Right, but what you said is really about putting yourself really in some way between the authorities and the state mm-hmm. and regular people. But is there any last thing in your thoughts about this, Holly?
I think you have to love gossip and love stories and love hearing stories and love hearing them more than once and figuring out how to tell that story, how to enable the person to tell her or his own story when he or she is able. Not everybody accused of crime is able to withstand the stress and actually tell it. But that's the main thing. And then you need to love codes. A lot of people who like law like crossword puzzles because they like filling in the blanks. A lot of people, as it turns out, who like law like medieval history. Because a lot of it is about parsing little bits of information to try to see what the whole story is and tease it out. But I think it's really more than anything. It's about liking people and wanting to see what you can do to help them extricate themselves from a problem.
Let's talk about when you were held in contempt.
Well, it was one of my – well, I was held in contempt several times.
Yeah.
but the one case that keeps coming back to me is one where I was held in contempt by the trial level court for not disclosing the whereabouts of a client. And the middle level appellate court reversed the contempt judgment with a great opinion. That's the only one to read, really. Commonwealth versus McGuigan, the appellate court. Then the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the highest court, overturned that, but actually narrowed the judgment enough that we could live with it. But there were a couple things about it. One is it took so long. The prosecutors really did not care about getting the information. They really just wanted to bother me. It took forever. I mean, they took 3 years to file this and then 4 years to file that. Oh, it was ridiculous. They just wanted to keep it hanging over me. And so there were two terrific things about it. One was at the trial level, the prosecutor says after the judge holds me in contempt – prosecutor says you have to tell her to pay – he assessed a fine of $100 a day. You have to tell her to pay it to the probation department. The judge says, I'm not going to do that. Why waste their time? It's just a waste of paperwork. No, you have to. Otherwise, we can't hold her in an additional contempt for not having paid it. And the judge says, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to waste their time. I'm not going to waste my time. Because think about it. She's not going to pay a nickel, not a dime. Forget $100 a day. She's never going to pay. Right, McGuigan? Not one dime.
So I loved that.
I felt so proud.
Well, Holly, we so appreciate your being with us. And we call this segment Lawyers You'll Like, but in this case, it's Lawyers You'll Love.
Oh,
so Holly McGuigan, really fabulous.
It was fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Holly.
That was great, Holly. Jesus.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.